Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Joining us now is a professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of University of Pennsylvania. Also, the new book out, The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust, Kevin Werbach. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you for having me.
We saw just the last couple of days, people were reminded a year ago where Bitcoin was. It was, you know, close to $20,000 of Bitcoin, and now it's dropped down to a couple thousand dollars worth of Bitcoin. So people are starting to talk about cryptocurrencies again, what the future is going to be. So I think this will be a fascinating topic. I want to first get your definitions of, so we kind of know we're on the same grounds. Can you define what a blockchain is, and can you define what a cryptocurrency is?
Absolutely. And this is a source of tremendous confusion, that people confuse Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, blockchain, and get fixated on the price fluctuation in these currencies and miss the bigger picture. So a blockchain is, it's actually a family of technologies for decentralized trust, that you can be confident of shared information between different parties who are all communicating together. So it essentially allows you to exchange value without having any kind of central intermediary, like a bank. Each party has their own copy of the information, but they're confident in the security, and they're confident that they're all seeing the same information. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can do with that is create a currency, create something that operates like money, because you're just looking at the ledger as the record of transactions and the record of accounts. So cryptocurrencies are a use of blockchain technology, really the first use that got blockchain technology to take off. And the first example of the cryptocurrencies was Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. And that one of the few that reached as high as we saw, $20,000 at some certain point. And people were always wondering, you know, what's going to happen? People were speculating. They said, this is going to keep rising. This will be the future. But then it started tapering off over the past year and started leveling off. And you think that might be a good thing, because maybe expectations were too high there for a while.
There's no question we were in a bubble. And even at the time, people understood this was a speculative frenzy. Blockchain is an incredibly exciting technology, and cryptocurrencies are a really important potential application of that technology. But the market was clearly getting ahead of itself. If you look at the adoption levels and the maturity of the technology, not that much changed from 2016 to 2017, and yet suddenly there was this huge spike in trading activity and prices of these what are called crypto assets. And so what's happened is the market has come back to reality. Of course, it overcorrects on the upside and overcorrects on the downside. But I think people are asking the right question now, which is, all right, what are these things actually useful for? And how far along are we at understanding what the killer apps are? The reality is we're still pretty early. This is not like the internet once it fully took off and got to the mainstream. This is still at the stage where the basic technological platforms are being built.
Yeah, and it felt like a lot of people were trying to commodity trade with their own money, which also could be dangerous. And I don't. The hard part for me when I look at something like this, I look at the Bitcoin thing, and of course that scares me away. But then I also read trade industry, and they talk about how a lot of different companies are starting to accept certain parts of cryptocurrency for payment for their own products, and they're also opening it up past just the U.S. dollar or something like that. So who really uses this technology right now, and who do you think will use this technology in the future?
Yeah, and that's really a key question. So the use for retail payments was the initial goal of Bitcoin. But most of these cryptocurrencies, and there's close to 2,000 of them that have been created, are designed for other kinds of purposes. They're designed to create platforms for distributed applications, basically like a new kind of computing platform, or to actually power those applications. So the reality is that actually very few people are using Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies as a substitute for dollars or euro or other traditional currencies, because the reality is most of the time those payment systems work quite well. PayPal and Venmo and all these things are actually really good for what they do. The cryptocurrencies are useful in particular for international transactions, because they're not tied to a particular country. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more adoption, for example, in banks and companies using this for international payments, where there's actually a tremendous amount of inefficiency in moving money across borders. There's some use in remittances, which is when people from other countries come and immigrate and they send money back home to their families. Those are some of the early applications for payments. But again, that's just one piece of the equation. There's this whole other world where companies are, in some cases, not even using the cryptocurrencies. They're using the blockchain technology, basically, as a new kind of decentralized record-keeping mechanism. And that can get applied really in any kind of business process where there are multiple companies working together who don't fully trust each other.
You know, joining us now is Kevin Werbeck. He has a new book, The Blockchain in the New Architecture of Trust. What happens when governments step in and they say, you know, I don't want to use this? I think we saw maybe, was it South Korea or in some other, maybe China and some of these foreign countries that say they just want to step out of it altogether?
Well, governments, people thought, would try to ban all of this. So the first thought was, oh, this is a new kind of money that doesn't come from the government. They're going to try to stop it. And the reality is they haven't. And certainly our government hasn't tried to stop it. For the most part, it said, wow, this is a fascinating innovation. We want to facilitate its growth, but we have to ensure that certain public policy obligations are met. And really what's happened is governments and regulators have gradually gained an understanding of what the issues are. So the fact that this is not a form of currency controlled by governments shouldn't mean that it becomes very easy to engage in money laundering or sending money to terrorists or other kinds of illegal activities like that. So there's work going on to ensure, for example, that the exchanges where you buy cryptocurrencies have to comply with basic requirements for information security. There's problems where there's fraud going on. These token offerings or initial coin offerings that people may have seen where a lot of these cryptocurrencies got offered, a substantial percentage of them were just out-and-out fraud. They were just total scams. And that's what happens. If you've got a Wild West environment, some people are going to abuse the technology. So actually what's starting to happen, at least in this country and the smart countries, is regulators are saying we actually have a role to promote trust in this area. Trust is not just confidence that the currency goes from point A to point B. You have to be willing to transact, and that means having an overall confidence level, and government involvement in a good way can help that.
Our guest is Kevin Werbeck. He is a professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He has a book called The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust, and looking at cryptocurrencies, its future, how he thinks it'll be integrated into really everyday life, even if you don't ever see it. Ooh, we'll continue our conversation with him next on Overnight America KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. I'm your host, Ryan Recker, and joining us is the author of the book, The Blockchain in the New Architecture of Trust. What do you know about cryptocurrencies? Well, there's actually a lot that goes into it. He sees a future with it, and he sees a lot of big companies, even banks, using this sort of technology. And we'll continue our conversation now with author Kevin Werbeck. How can you comply with security regulations? It seems like a lot of these cryptocurrencies are hands-off, and they approach it as in, you know, we're just going to stay out of it. It's just one person and one person, and you guys are making your own transactions between each other. And how do you actually regulate something like that?
So that's a lot of what I talk about in the book. It's not just one issue. And we're not just talking about one cryptocurrency or one use of blockchain technology. There are a variety of different answers to that question in different contexts. But the short version is there's this notion that this technology is inherently anonymous and there's no way to control it. It turns out, actually, there are, in most cases, identified actors. There are people who set up the networks. There are people who create applications, or people who create the software, and they are hooks, potentially, to be regulated, because they're doing things like if you set up a website and you set up a service and say, okay, give me your money. Some of these ICOs raised $100 million from people. Mm-hmm. You can be found, and if what you're doing is committing fraud, then the regulators can find you and should regulate you. The issue is, where are there opportunities where the technology creates new possibilities? For example, new kinds of applications that really aren't traditional securities offerings. And there's possibly a new space that shouldn't be under the existing legal frameworks, and that's a lot of what the debate is right now among the regulators in the industry, is where can we find that space? But the reality is most of what's going on, it's actually not that hard to put it into the existing boxes. It just takes a little time and effort.
Mm. Kevin Werbach joins us on KMOX, and we're talking about his book, The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust. A lot of times you see these things where the person may be, you know, trying to hack and say, oh, we'll give you up your files if you send us a Bitcoin or whatever it is. And you see some of these scammers using this type of technology. So let's say the person that's doing this is on foreign soil. You're here in the United States. Does the U.S. government even step in? Are there even examples of them trying to actually make these right? Or do they at this point say, oh, we don't have the resources. I'm sorry you got scammed and that's all we can do?
Oh, sure. So it's important to understand in that situation, Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency might be used as the payment mechanism for that ransomware, but the crime is the ransomware. The crime really has nothing to do with the cryptocurrency. Mm. And so there's no reason to shut down the Bitcoin transaction. You have to go after the criminals, and that's what they're doing. But there have been situations where the cryptocurrency itself is actually integral to the illegal activity. And there, yes, there have been situations where people have been extradited, where there are large-scale frauds being committed. The U.S. authorities work together with other authorities. So that can actually happen. And in most cases, the issue is, are you targeting U.S. citizens? That's been an issue with a lot of these token offerings, even if the legal entity is in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands or something, if they're clearly marketing to Americans and taking their money and understanding that's who their customers are, this is not a new phenomenon for regulators. They understand how to deal with that. The reality is countries all over the world are trying to address this, and they're starting to work together to figure out where they need to harmonize. You mentioned countries like China. There are some countries that have just banned some of this activity. But actually, behind the scenes, China's been very aggressive at developing the core technical infrastructure of blockchain and applying it to existing business processes and actually looking into issuing a digital version of their own currency. So we're seeing a variety of different strategies around the world, and that's really going to be the competition, which country can have the most forward-looking approach here.
Ah, the forward-looking approach. So you're going to do a crystal ball and say the future of this and trying to figure out if this is going to be something that's integrated into our culture, as in everyone's going to use the blockchain and, you know, centralized banking is going to be in the minority at some point. Do you ever see that happening?
Absolutely, but you're not going to notice it. So you don't know what technology your bank runs for its core systems. Your bank is going to deploy this technology because it's actually much more efficient for them, and they're not going to tell you that that's what they're doing. And there'll be some new entrants that leverage this technology, just as with the internet, to compete. But it's going to get integrated into the existing financial system and into the existing conduct of business. That's one of the reasons, going back to what we talked about at the start, that this technology of blockchain and cryptocurrencies hasn't really reached its potential, and why the market boom last year was overstated. There aren't yet good user experiences that hide the complexity. People don't want to understand which coin you're using and which wallet you have to use. That's never going to get to a mass market. So we're going to see this get developed in a way that more and more people will actually be using systems that depend on blockchain, but they won't even know it.
Ah, so you don't necessarily see in the future where you're going to log into your banking account and see now that you own Bitcoin as part of your 401k, but the banks could use that technology as a way to make things more efficient on their back end.
Yeah, you might do it just as an investment. So the part of this world that is taking off fastest is the least revolutionary part, which is just using these cryptocurrencies to create new kinds of digital assets, and then just trading them like other assets. So as an investment opportunity, sure, but it'll be like a bunch of mutual funds or whatever else you have in your 401k. That's not really changing the way that you interact with the financial system. What's going to change more is actually behind the scenes. How are things actually moving around in that trading application that you're using? And more, I think that's going to incorporate blockchain technology. But again, that's the part that you're not going to see as the end user. The interesting thing is some of these decentralized applications where you use tokens to for example, pay for file storage online or to pay for content online through micropayments and so forth. And I think we're going to start to see some of that, but that's the part that's slowest because it requires the most change in people's behavior.
Ah, okay. Well, the new book's out, The Blockchain in the New Architecture of Trust. Where can people find it?
Anywhere you buy books, or you can go to trusttheblockchain.net.
Ah, can you purchase this with a cryptocurrency?
Depends where you buy it.
Yeah.
Certainly at some places. But, yeah, the reality is most of the major retailers at this point don't take that. But that's, again, that's part of what I talk about in the book is where we are in reality.
Kevin Werbeck, the book, The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Absolutely. Thank you, too.
Anytime. He joins us on the Quiver River Electric guest line. I got a couple minutes here. I might as well tell you a story. Is Producer Mike in that room? Producer Mike, are you there? Oh, no, he's out. He would love this story. I'm going to tell you this one. I told the story last year, and during the holiday season, my wife's aunt sends out some very detailed family updates with their Christmas card. So they'll put the family Christmas card in, and she'll send a letter. Here's what everyone's doing. Here's what everyone's saying. Here's what the everything going on. And last year, it was quite controversial because they send out the Christmas card. And in the letter, they break the news that the one guy that is dating their daughter is about to propose to her. Apparently, he asked the father ahead of time, and they put it in the card before he proposed. The card that they sent out to all the family members, all of them. And it was very controversial. So why would you do that? Why would you break the news through the Christmas letter? And this poor guy, he just wants to make this a special moment for him and his bride-to-be. And yes, they're married now, but what a weird thing to put in there. And no, you just don't do that. Terrible etiquette. So that was a interesting tidbit in last year's letter. We got this year's letter in. And my wife's reading it. She's like, oh, I can't wait to see what's in it. This is going to be, I'm sure there's something in there. So they're going down the list of all the family members and what they're doing. Now they're happily married and they mention the guy. And this is what they say. Everyone gets their own paragraph. Oh, so-and-so did this and this and this, and they traveled to here, and they did this, and here's their hobbies, and here's that. So they all get these really big descriptions of their lives, the things that are going on. Pretty much if they went to the dentist and there were no cavities, they put this in the update. Everything. So they finally get to this guy, the one that they broke the news about the proposal about the year before, and he only gets one sentence. One sentence. Everyone else gets a paragraph or two, and they tell everything that happened over the past year. One sentence for the guy. You know what the sentence was? He's doing good and keeps an eye on the dogs. What? Wait, everyone gets their own thing? Oh, so-and-so's doing great. Oh, they're doing this. Oh, the dentist appointment was fine. And no, I mean, they talked about everything with everyone else, and they get to this one guy. I guess he's responsible for watching the dogs. What? Come on. Maybe they just secretly hate this guy. I feel bad. Oh, I feel real bad. Maybe I'm not going to read the letter. I think last year I might have left out the key details, but gave you the spirit of the letter. This year, whew, I love these things. So this is my grand idea. I told this to my wife, and she said, no, I am not doing that. I said, we're going to set her up next year, or we can still do it this year. We're going to send her a Christmas card. We'll make up a fake letter with a bunch of fake things inside and see how long it takes for some of that information to get back to us. Like it's a giant gossip column. She said, no, I'm not doing that. I think it's genius myself, setting people up with Christmas letters. Up next, I want to do a couple of tech stories. This is crazy. You ever see the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? There's a little ray gun. And then they're little tiny things smaller than ants and they're running around and oh, everything's crazy. It's Rick Moranis deal. Well, MIT scientists have actually figured out how to shrink objects. This is no joke. It's crazy. And you may be thinking to yourself, this sounds like fake news. As far as I'm concerned, this very well is fake news, but it looks legit. Not that they're showing it to us. It's not a demonstration mode. And it's not like Willy Wonka either, where they're going to shrink you down if you're complaining like a kid. And it's not weaponized. Under certain circumstances, this works, and we'll go through the process next. Also, it's kind of fascinating. You see the story that came through about how they can 3D print your head, and then that lets hackers unlock your phone? See, it's a wild world we're living in today. It's Overnight America, KMOX. You know, I got to say, I didn't realize that they were playing Vancouver on Thursday. That means Overnight America will probably get on. So if it's 9 o'clock start time, 12:30, maybe, if they're lucky, because they're going to want to get out of there quick, we might only have a couple of hours together. You know what that means? Might as well put my feet up. It's going to be an easy Thursday night. Be in autopilot mode, just getting ready for Overnight America. But hey, we're here together tonight. And do you remember that classic Disney movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Did you get the machine to work?
A few more bucks to get out.
Then something quite unexpected happened.
Where are the kids?
I haven't seen them since I left this morning.
It shrunk the kids.
Nick, what happened?
It works.
Diane, I got something real important to tell you.
Are you trying to tell me
the machine works? Do the kids know?
Well, yeah, the kids know.
This is such a classic 90s trailer.
And then it was time to shrink the kids.
Now the voice guy comes in and it's very tightly wound up and they try to show as many clips as possible. Yeah, they've come a long way in movie trailers. So that's kind of where we're heading towards. You're not going to believe this. So Popular Mechanics and other news agencies, I mean, some really reputable news agencies are saying that it's not quite like Ant-Man or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but MIT scientists have mastered a way to shrink stuff. This is what it's called. It's called implosion fabrication. And you may hear that term fabrication and think this is all made up, but no, I guess this is a real thing. It says it's a way of putting nearly any kind of material into a 3D pattern with nanoscale precision. In a press release that came out from MIT, they say everything from metal to quantum dots to DNA strands have patterns that could be fabricated in an extreme miniature. It's not necessarily a 3D printer, but they use this process and they say, like, let me try to explain this to you. And I'm going to try to sound like I know what I'm talking about, but honestly, I have no idea. The MIT process takes a technique currently used that makes images of brain tissue larger and reverses it. So with the brain tissue expansion process embeds tissue into a gel, then expands it, then it allows for high resolution imaging to use and see it under a regular microscope. So they already have this in the medical world. And if you're someone that works a lab, you may have done this process before. It's kind of probably a cool, right? Oh, now you can zoom it up and you can see these things and what an advancement that was. So someone thought, can we Rick Moranis this thing and do it in reverse? Can we shrink it? In the backwards version, a large-scale object is placed in this gel. MIT students used a material made up of something that's found in diapers. Okay, don't ask me. I don't know. And then they used that and bathe it in molecules of an orange dye in a yellow-green fluorescent that's commonly used as a scientific marker. These markers act as anchors that can bind the other molecules, scientists might add. So during this process, they take something when they try to look under the microscope to brain cells, and then they reverse it to shrink it. So scientists then add up acid that hinders the negative charges in the gel, and these negative charges, the gel no longer repels itself to a molecular level and begins to contract, and it shrinks proportionately, equal to 1,000-fold reduction in volume. So the potential applications are widespread. According to MIT, specialized lens could be shrunk down to better study the fundamental properties of light. Smaller lenses could be made for cameras, cell phones, and other microphones, things like that. Farther into the future, the process could even be helpful in creating nanorobots. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay, you're not seeing the part where they, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids part yet.
That's great.
It's not that great.
Why?
I shrunk the kids.
So we're not going to be shrinking any kids just yet. Sorry, Rick Moranis. I wonder what he's up to. I hope he's doing all right. Rick Moranis, I hope you're doing fine. So that's what they're doing. They're shrinking things. How many text messages did that guy get today? Hey, did you see this story from MIT? Their Honey the Shrunk I Kid story? No, did you see that? Honey Shrunk the Kid? And he's probably turning his cell phone off. Stop calling me. Ugh. Family members. Here's another interesting hack that's going on. So you may have a security flaw on your phone. If you use the camera to unlock your phone, there's a couple of different options. Like there could be a little fingerprint scanner on the back of your phone. A lot of the newer ones probably made in the last year or two or three have these little fingerprint scanners. And if you
move your finger over it. It'll read your thumbprint or your fingerprint or whatever it is. And then it'll unlock your phone for you. So it's a way to get around having to type in the passcode every time. Okay? So there's another option, and Apple started using this. They took the camera on your phone, and you hold it up to your face, and your face, it's like a facial recognition that you see in a lot of the tech movies. Facial recognition would be used to unlock your phone. Now, there's a couple of downsides to these things. Number one, if police get your phone, for some reason they think you're part of a crime, they may force you to try to unlock this, or they may just, you know, let's say you're dead, by the way. There's even instances where police officers have gone into a funeral where you're in the coffin, took your fingers and unlocked your phone if they thought it could be helpful in some sort of investigation. Why? Because dead people apparently don't have rights, so you have that going for you. Same thing with your face. If you have this sort of thing and they hold it up to your face, it can unlock your phone, and it's also another way to get around the privacy of things. That's why I don't do any of that stuff. I'm fine with the passcode. But geniuses said, well, I wonder if we can fool the system. I wonder if we could take a mold of someone's fingerprints, like let's say really Mission Impossible stuff, and they'll sneak in and they'll find a glass you held onto, and they'll get a nice sample of your fingerprint, and they'll make a little mold of it, and then they'll put it as like if it's a glove, and then they'll try to unlock your phone. And you know what? Those sort of tricks have started to work. I've seen people trick the system that way. Not easy to do, not practical to do, but it's possible. They thought, well, let's see if we can do the same thing with a 3D printer. We'll take a 3D printer and we'll print off a replica of a human head, and then we'll hold it up to a phone and see if it unlocks. So bad news is, if you're an Android user, it probably will work if the 3D printer is good enough. If you're an iPhone user, it will not work. Oh, how about that? Seems like the days of the trusty passcode are gone. I'm looking at this from website TechCrunch. So there's always ways around some of this technology. The thing is, think of everything that's on your phone. Think if there's maybe sensitive information. Hopefully you're not taking pictures of yourself that are provocative or whatever it is. You know, some people do that sort of thing, right? They'll do that. They'll take the photos or whatever, and they'll think, oh, I'm going to be the only one to see it. Then someone hacks onto your phone, and then they try to ransom you for those photos. And it happens to celebrities all the time. There's always leaks and things of people that were stolen on phones. But it's not just compromising photos of you or people you know. It could even be beyond that. Think about maybe you have accounts that you have logged into your phone, okay, or things saved onto your phone that may be documents that have sensitive information like tax documents or social security numbers or banking documents or whatever it is. Let's say there's other things, proprietary information. Maybe you have some other documents you viewed on there that only you were supposed to see, you know, mortgage applications or, you know, something for your business or whatever it is, things that you don't want other people to know. Well, if someone steals your phone and they find a way to get into it, that could be very dangerous. Well, same thing when it comes to investigations. Obviously, you want to be able to protect yourself. Obviously, you don't want people to be able to break into your phone. And if it's a policing agency or the FBI or whatever it is, you don't want them just getting in because they hold the phone up to your face, right? You want them to be able to get a warrant or do it in a certain way. But even then, you shouldn't have to voluntarily break all your own privacies just because that's the convenient thing to do. So the FBI alone has thousands of devices in custody, and they're always trying to find ways to break the encryption or break into it, find easier ways to do it. So just watch out. I'm saying just be careful. There's a lot of ways to break into these certain things, and don't make it any easier for them if you don't have to. All right, there was a celebrity death. Penny Marshall passing away at the age of 75 last night. I want to talk about Laverne and Shirley. Are there any Laverne and Shirley fans? I watched it a little bit when I was younger. I haven't seen her in a long time. Every once in a while, she'd pop up in an interview. But yeah, passing away at the age of 75. Let's talk about that on Overnight America KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. This is one of those age issues. I wasn't around when there was new Laverne and Shirley's on the air, as far as I can remember. If I was, I was way too young to watch it. Oh yeah, lasted until 1983, so nope, sorry. I can't remember. I don't have any memories of watching and talking about Laverne and Shirley. I remember seeing them on rerun every once in a while. I knew they were popular. Laverne and Shirley, actress Penny Marshall, passing away at the age of 75.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hudson Bamber Incorporated. We're gonna do it. Give us any chance, we'll take it.
I need a theme song like this. This is a good one.
We're gonna make our dreams come true. Do it our way.
Da-da-da-da-da. Get the orchestra going and everything. How nice is that? So this is kind of an honest question. If you remember watching the show when it was on the air, was this actually a good show, or, you know, does it hold up the test of time? Because I've kind of watched a couple of episodes, never really got into it. It's, you know, it's kind of your typical thing. It's got a killer theme song, though. Listen to that. That's a great theme song. So the announcement came out from the Marshall family. Our family is heartbroken over the passing of Penny Marshall. Publicist died Monday night due to diabetes complications. Wow. You don't see that often. That's a shame. 75 years old, though. So Laverne and Shirley burst into the TV scene, a mid-season replacement, January of 76, lasted all the way till 83. It's not easy to last that long. Let's see. Her career went on, accomplished director in Hollywood, directing movies like A League of Their Own and Big. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know she did Big. That's actually big time. Let me bring up Bob real quick. Hey, Bob, what's going on?
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Ryan, back in the day on a Saturday Night Live, there was a Christmas skit where they had Penny Marshall as a nun playing a piano, and she had a little nippy bottle. And there was Rosie O'Donnell and Whitney Houston doing this Christmas play. And I thought that that was one of the funniest Christmas plays they ever did.
You lost me at Rosie. I was going to look it up until you said that name.
Oh, okay.
You lost. Well, okay, what did you watch the show when it was on?
What's that, Laverne and Shirley?
Yeah.
No, I didn't care for that show.
I'm trying to remember if it was any good. I know that it, I don't know if it holds up the test of time, but I know people really love it.
Yeah. Now, the other characters with it, they had some guy who was always combing his hair like a Fonzie guy, but he could dance real well.
Well, I remember was it Squiggy
cool
and someone else?
Yeah, it was Squiggy and another guy. It was Squiggy and a taller guy. But then there was also another guy who was real cool, and he could dance real good and things like that.
Okay, I'll have to look him up. Yeah, I remember they always followed him around.
I know they worked in a brewery.
Yes, and I know that one of the only things I know is that when Wayne's World mocked that and did it as part of their film, that's how I knew it was kind of a big deal. Yeah. Was it Squiggy and Lenny? McKeon was Lenny, and yeah, how about that? I don't know if you've seen any of the Better Call Saul on AMC, but he is excellent on that show.
Really?
Penny Marshall, 178 episodes. I had no idea. They must have cranked those things out. 178 episodes of Laverne and Shirley? That's sometimes you don't know if you can do a quality show and put that many out at the same time.
Yeah, but that Christmas skit they did, that was so funny. But on Saturday Night Live's Christmas shows, that's never aired.
Yeah. It never aired?
No, that was never on there.
Oh, weird. So how do you know it exists?
Well, because I've seen it. I've seen it when it was on television.
Oh, so you saw the compilation episodes they don't put in.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but when they have all them different ones from all the Christmases past, they never include that in that show.
Yeah. Well, she had a lot of friends. She just for the fact that she made Big and League of Their Own and things like that, that's very,
that
very talented.
Movie.
All of those are. All right, well, thanks for calling in, Bob. Good to hear from you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Well, I don't remember if it holds up. I'm sure there'll be some sort of TV Land retrospective, and they'll show a bunch of episodes. Maybe I'll try to catch one, even though I don't have TV Land. Maybe I'll just Google a couple of clips and See what happens from there. Here's from CBS, remembering actress and director Penny Marshall.
Carol Penny Marshall, named after Carol Lombard, was born 75 years ago in the Bronx. While her older brother Gary, who created Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley,
yes, Mr. Unger, I'm spraying right now,
gave her her first break as Myrna the Secretary in The Odd Couple, Penny Marshall earned her Hollywood star all on her own. Today, her ex-husband Rob Reiner tweeted, "I loved Penny. I was very lucky to have lived with her and her funny bone."
Oh, legacy. I don't know. I did. I was successful. I had a successful TV show. I had a couple successful movies. And I'm not beautiful.
She was two-thirds right.
Are you crazy?
Because the way she made us laugh.
Boy, you just love to see me embarrassed, don't you?
Was a gorgeous gift. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, New York.
Oh, that's really nice. It's funny how she's like, yeah, I was able to do all these things and I wasn't a looker. I like that. That's actually really goes to show you she had quite a personality on her. She'll be missed. 75 years old. Penny Marshall passing away. There was a quick thing. I'm going to get this. I saw this on KMOX's website the other day. Are you familiar with the term choosy beggar? It's pretty popular online. People will post up their stories of people that are begging for things, but they're very choosy about it. Goes back to the phrase, you know, beggars can't be choosers. And the first thing I thought of when I read this article, Missouri is giving away a Jefferson County bridge to anyone who wants it. Says the Missouri Department of Transportation giving away a Jefferson County bridge that was built during the Great Depression for free. But there's a catch. There's an agency plans to demolish the truss bridge and carries cars across this creek over State Route 61 in Jefferson County. Unless the state officials find a new owner, anyone interested must be willing to either maintain the structure or pay for it to be removed. Okay. So if you want it for free, you got to come pick it up and you have to disassemble it all. Now, come on. So you want someone, because you're cheap right now, which, you know, maybe it's probably better that people that are maintaining the spending here in the state of Missouri are trying to do things on the cheap. But are there people lining up saying, yeah, I want to just hire a bunch of people to take down this bridge at no cost so I can turn around and make no money off of this thing? Yeah, let me raise my hand and start volunteering for this right away. The Department of Transportation's partners have practiced of making historic bridges that they plan to remove available for use to others. Multiple federal grants can make up to 80% of demolition costs available to potentially reimburse those interested in reusing the bridge. I don't know. I think to myself, who's lining up to do all the labor in the moving and reassembling and all of this stuff? No one is. You see that all the time. You see people post things online. Hey, you know, I have this deck in the backyard. It's yours for free. If you want the lumber, you just have to tear it all down, a.k.a. you don't want to pay to have someone do the labor to come remove your deck. Or you see that with, oh, I got a big concrete patch. Anyone that wants it, you know, scrap concrete, come and pick it up. But hey, you gotta break it all up and you gotta remove it. You gotta do this and you gotta do that. Choosy beggar stuff. Now, if you get an opportunity to go online and see some of these choosy beggars, that's the name of it. There's all kinds of examples of it. And it's ridiculous. It's just rampant all over. You gotta be careful too. You go on these sites, people are always selling things locally. It's not just like these Craigslist deals, but people have all kinds of different local forums they'll go to. And they'll do this thing, and what they'll end up doing is always trying to weasel their way in to get a little bit extra. Like, there'll be people giving away free things, like old tube TVs. They just want to get away, and they're like, ah, I could throw it away, but maybe someone will get a use out of this TV. And then they'll say, oh, great. Oh, TV's for free. Can you come to my house and deliver it? I'm only about, oh, I don't know, 40 miles away. No, of course I can't do something like that. That's crazy talk. That's just the world we live in anymore. All right, so coming up in the next hour, we'll do this thing called Tell Me Something Good. Do you have something good you'd like to share? I would love to hear it if you do. And Ford has designed something for dogs. I guess it's kind of a cool idea. We'll get to that too. You can call in or text the show 314-436-7900 on Overnight America KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.